Greetings, nerds. This is Being a Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Polk. How are you doing today, Will?
Doing very well, Sarah. It's good to be talking to you this evening.
Yeah, it's a summer weekend.
Yeah, it is. It's been a while since we've done a night recording, so it's just like, let's keep this energy up.
Yeah, it's weird to record in the afternoon, but then when you do it like consecutively, it feels comfortable, and now at night it's different.
It is. I'd say this evening after I've gotten used to saying this afternoon, but yeah, but I've had a good weekend. Just family's been here and got the end of year celebrations with school and stuff. I'm sure a lot of our listeners probably identify with that. So it's good times.
Yep. Will's been partying all weekend while I've been studying all weekend.
Yeah, you've been a good kid studying.
Just was so much fair. Speaking of surprises, though, I want to take 2 minutes to talk about this because we don't talk about the 100 on this show, but I still watch. I fell off in season 4, I'll be honest, and then came back season 5, and season 6 is actually doing pretty well. And all of us fans got a big, big surprise over the weekend when it was announced that the stars of the 100 literally got married. And this is a big deal because, A, no one knew they were dating.
Oh, wow.
No one knew that. C, and then B, we have wanted the ship Bellark for so long. I mean, since season 1, I can probably name the scene where we all were like, that's my ship. And we have not gotten any of it. Like zero, nothing. It's been a lot of eye contact, a lot of like little touches, but no like legitimate relationship.
That's funny.
However, clearly in the real life, we are winning because they're married now.
Yes. You guys got the ultimate ship. Not only. So your shipping was not misplaced. It just didn't happen on screen. It happened off.
Yeah. It's, you know, if the writers want to screw us out of that happy ending, which based on the books should be a thing, but isn't apparently on the show, you know, we are winning in real life. But it's crazy in my mind, though, how these two could get away with that, considering how much information is online and people not recognizing, like some people looking back on it were like, well, clearly there were signs, but still they even got engaged and nobody knew about it.
Wow. Yeah. Cause I mean, when you look at like, for example, Chris Pratt and Katherine Schwarzenegger, you know, they got married this weekend and I think their relationship was, spoiled a little early or did they? And I guess the one that immediately came to mind when you started talking about this and trying to keep it on the down low was, Jamie Foxx and
Katie Holmes.
Yeah, Katie Holmes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I feel like people have been even speculating about those two for a while now.
Yeah.
Are they married? Or are they still dating?
I think they're still dating. But I think they're now officially public with it.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to put it out there because I saw that Friday night and it just blew up my timeline for the rest of the weekend.
Yeah, I think I saw you say something about, I think our friend Veronica and a few other of our mutuals were retweeting it, the news. So I was like, huh, okay. I can't wait to hear Sarah talk about this and illuminate my knowledge on this because I don't watch the 100, so.
Yeah, well, clearly some of our guest hosts need to come back and we need to talk about the 100 this season because some things are happening. And the Bellark ship may have just dissipated considering the most recent chain of events. So anyways, moving on to other things. Also something happened this weekend. A big franchise movie was released called X-Men Dark Phoenix. Will, do we care?
I don't.
I don't either.
I saw you put that on the rundown. I was like, are you just putting that there so we could just like, you know, just kick a little bit of dirt on Fox as far as the last film to come out, that they produced pre-merger.
Not necessarily. I'm just putting it out there because I recognize that it's a thing. It's happening.
Yeah, it is
happening. I think if you watch the trailer, you understand the movie. Also, from what I've heard, if you've seen Captain Marvel, you understand the movie.
Yeah. Also, I think I don't know if it was Collider or something I was watching this or last week where they were talking some similarities to another superhero movie. And apparently... Awesome. Yeah, and apparently the beginning is very reminiscent of Shazam.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, that was one of the things I heard that because I saw where and I know they reshot the ending as well, and I think that was due to maybe one of the recent MCU films that they redid the ending, but even the beginning apparently it was very very close. Copycat of Shazam. People, if you've seen both, let us know. I haven't seen the movie, obviously. I know it just, since we do sometimes keep track of box office stuff, I saw where it did come in at 140 million globally, this with their initial take. But the same article I read also anticipates that they're going to lose about $100 million on this film as well, so.
Yeah. Well, it's another reason, like, why even do it in the first place?
Yeah.
Apocalypse, like, sunk the franchise, in my opinion.
Yeah, that the latest round of X films, I haven't really been very enthusiastic about seeing, and which is very sad, considering that when you think about the legacy of the X-Men films, it really did kick off the renaissance of the superhero genre. When you think back to the original X-Men and X2 in particular, it really did. So it's kind of sad that it sort of ends with a whimper instead of a bang.
It's interesting when you put it in that context because it may have started it, but it's also like the little engine, so to speak. It's that like we want it to do good, but it just never reaches the even Days of Future Past, which is one of the better versions of the films, and the more times I rewatch it, the less it really holds up. So yeah, every time that I rewatch that film, it holds up less and less, and I don't really know why. I just feel like either it's too big of a cast, too many stars to really allow people to stay in the franchise. I don't know what I'm talking about anymore, Will.
No,
you're not
fine.
Helping me at all.
I was just letting you, get your point out. I will say that to your point, as far as the X universe, I think some of their spinoffs, like Deadpool, for example, and Logan, really have been the tentpole movies, but for whatever reason, when they do the core X-Men here lately, it's just has been disappointing, just like the DCEU has been disappointing for many fans as well. So I think hopefully, with the new merger and with Fox and Disney getting a hold of the property and Marvel Studios can maybe start fresh. With the next phase of integrating these characters into phase 4 or phase 5.
Yeah, it's like they can never match the 90s TV show.
No, nothing can match that show. It was just pretty genius.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you should be able to do some of that stuff in live action. It shouldn't be that hard, and I feel like every time they try, they put characters who should be on the team elsewhere, and it never really makes sense. Like, there's something about the harmony of that group that we were exposed to initially via the cartoon that just felt right.
Right.
And they've never been able to recapture that.
Fair enough. And, you know, maybe I'll watch this when it comes to streaming service down the road, but I won't be adding to the take at the box office.
Yeah. No, neither will I. But you know, I have other things. Like TV has been blowing up my life lately.
Yeah, it's been a lot. A lot of good. good stuff out there. And it just seems to be more and more, like, good things coming on. And it's just getting harder and harder to keep up.
Like, this week, I have not watched more things in one solid week before. Where one night I watched Always Be My Maybe on Netflix. Decent film. Go check it out if you wanted to. Another night I spent getting caught up and watching When They See Us, which we'll talk about in a little bit later. Another night I spent getting caught up on season 3 of The Handmaid's Tale. And it just keeps coming and coming. And then today, it's a sad day, Will. It's a sad, sad day. You want to know why?
What's sad day, Sarah?
Because Billy in season 4 is done.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And you're going to have to wait another year before you get another season, I'm sure.
And they left me in the most vulnerable place. I don't appreciate it, writers. Because they've been stringing along this Wendy and Axe thing, and they got all... I feel like they're playing chess with me, Will. I feel like these writers, every season, they get on a new board, they set the pieces, I think I know how they're setting it up, and then they kill the queen, and I don't even have a chance. And, well, this season, I will admit, I think I prefer seasons 2 and 3. I feel like they... The twists in those seasons caught me off more on guard, where the big twist this season I saw coming. Mm. And so it wasn't as shocking. However, the way they've now replaced everyone, which basically, spoiler alert, at the end of the last season, Chuck Rhodes and Axe actually became allies for this fourth season. But then in this finale, yeah, because of Wendy, they will clearly never be allies. It's never going to be a thing. There's always going to be her in between, and her getting her way from one versus the other, and the rivalry is all bred through that relationship. But it should be Axe and Wendy. Okay? It should be.
I've only watched a few episodes of season 1. I did enjoy it, but, at some point, I'll go back and try to get caught up with you, but, I'll take your word for it.
Yeah. Like I said before, season 4, not my favorite season of the bunch. I still think 2 is like my favorite, 3 is close behind. However, I love these writers because I feel like they know the story they're telling every season. Mm-hmm. And it feels well planned out, well thought out, and it's just like another installment of this saga that they're trying to tell. So I'm very excited for season 5.
I know you are. I mean, you have been a big champion for Billions, and have reminded me on multiple occasions how I should like watch the show. And I know Pete has told me that, has also shared that with me as well. So as I said, I will get caught up, and maybe since I saw this weekend that The Good Place is actually ending its run, and with the fourth season, that'll be opening on my TV watching, that I can fill with this.
I'm a little surprised about that cancellation, and then I'm not entirely surprised.
Yeah, the showrunner, he basically said that he is ending it on it, and because basically he feels that the arc of the show is such that he saw a lot like Sam Esmail and Mr. Robot. He had a vision for the show, and it's a good, you know, and he's taken the characters where they wanted to go, and has had places where they, you know, run off and do things that they didn't even imagine when they first started crafting the show. But they're definitely in it, and it's a good place to be, where you're in a show on your own terms instead of it being ended for you, like one that we're going to talk about this evening.
Yeah, let's just jump right in. That's like the perfect segue to have the Swamp Thing conversation on, because it's also been lighting up everybody's timeline since came out, that, you know, only after airing its pilot, season 1 has been Well, season one has not been canceled. They're still going to release all the episodes, but season two and any after have been canceled.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a lot of reaction on the cancellation. A lot of information and disinformation and misinformation was out there as well as far as what were the reasons behind it. And I whenever I first saw the news, I guess this was, I believe, when word came down that not even a full week after the pilot aired, the show was given the axe. And so immediately I started thinking about the fact that the episode order was cut back in April. And that was, I guess, the first sign of potential trouble when they went from 13 to 10. And at the time, the reasoning was that Warner Brothers and just did not like the way that the program was going. And so, and seeing now, we've seen two episodes, and you know, this gets to the larger landscape of media companies getting bought up and merged and all those kind of things. And when those things happen, you know, obviously, you know, the new company that takes over may have different visions for stuff. And I think it sounds like Swamp Thing was a victim of that. And then the second thing, as when the cancellation news came out, it was over a question about the finances. And there was a lot of things blown out there, in the internets about, the show's budget and issues here in North Carolina where I live and our film credit program. What happened with, you know, what was the story there? And, I happened to read the show's was produced in Wilmington, North Carolina, which is in the southeast coast of our state. And it's what Georgia is now as far as we used to have, just to give a little bit of context, a pretty robust film industry in this state. But due to changing in political parties and whims and our film program, funding for the program and everything got restructured.
Right.
And so, and it continues to get tweaked. So I think that also added to some of the confusion. But I mean, essentially the way the program works is it's a 25% rebate for a grant for production companies. And, there's a per project cap for each type of, venture. So there's a $12 million per season cap for television series. And so, I think what was happening with some of these stories, people were focusing on the 25%, and there was also apparently a part of the grant application that DC and Warner had put in for Swamp Thing showed that the production budget for the program was $85 million, which of course it completely met the criteria of a minimum spend of $1 million per episode for your average TV series. So there was no issues there, but somehow people focused on the 25%. And so then people were like, oh, you know, North Carolina, it was a paperwork error. And it was like, you know, state was going to put up $40 million. And that was actually not the case. The real issue is the program itself, the grant program, only allows for up to $12 million for the production. So there was no like paperwork errors or anything like that. The film office has been very clear that DC and Warner and North Carolina Film Office were having a great relationship. They were very excited about the program being filmed there. I mean, Screen Gem Studio they've put a huge investment in the infrastructure down there. There are a lot of people locally who benefit from the production. So it wasn't an issue about paperwork or anything like that. It was truly, it seems like it really was a creative thing that was going on here because they were only going to get $12 million, which they did qualify for the grant, but it was only going to be $12 million. It wasn't going to be $40 million like a lot of things that's been posted out there on the internet. So,
interesting.
Yeah. So that was just some bad reporting and bad information that people were putting out there. I think, you know, I saw it in multiple places, But that's just wrong, folks. It's only $12 million that they were going to get, and they did qualify for it, and there was no paperwork error. So,
well, yeah, you throw math out there, and yeah, suddenly everybody's like, "Oh, obviously it's a paper error. Obviously people can't add."
Yeah, yeah.
It's an easy excuse.
Easy excuse wasn't, yeah, but that is just, it was just wrong. So you've heard it here, and I've seen the local paper also made it very clear, and the North Carolina Film Office has made it very clear that, and even if you go to NC Film, it's very clear that yes, it's up to 25% rebate for the grant, but you have to then look at the next box, which has the, and I'll share it on our feed, how much television series, feature films, commercials get for the production.
Awesome. Well, thank you for clarifying all of that and telling the news, like, or telling everyone that it's fake news.
Yep. Yes, I can actually say, hey, that's fake news.
Now, the show has been canceled. It still is yet to remain if it will get picked up by entities such as Netflix or even HBO is a little bit interested in this series.
Yes. Yeah. I've seen that. I know people, I know a lot of wishful thinking folks at CW, but it just wouldn't fit in the Arrowverse or any kind of CW at all. If you've watched the first two episodes, this is a grown up show.
That doesn't sound like wishful thinking. That sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah.
The CW has way too many heroes right now. I have to tell you, they got trouble with their own heroes. Why add to that mix?
Yeah. Yeah.
So I did watch episode two.
I did too.
It was odd. I felt like it ended really quickly. Like, I know it was the same length as the pilot, and for some reason, I was just like, oh, okay, so we're here. Oh, we're done. Oh, okay. It was something about the way they managed their time with the different scenes that I felt like they were longer scenes, which made it feel like it was a really quick show because they only went to like a handful of places.
Yeah. I actually enjoyed it. Given the whole context of everything that's going on, I try to put that aside and just watch it for its own entertainment sake. And that being said, so I am, to bring it back to the cancellation, I am a little disappointed that it's canceled, because I do agree with you that there seemed to be some pacing issues on it. But at the same time, one of the things we talked about last week with the pilot was how were they going to build the relationship between Alec and Abby? Mm-hmm. And at the time I speculated, oh, it'd be flashbacks. Well, it wasn't flashbacks, but in a way it was just in this episode video recordings that Alec actually made whenever he was researching the swamp. And so I'm starting to see how they're trying to build the relationship and build the deep feelings between Alec and Abby. I'm still not 100% sold, but I give them give them A for effort.
I don't. I give them like a C for effort because I'm tired of people. Excuse me. I'm tired of writers thinking that builds ship wars or people wanting two people to get together is to see a little tape recorder and like, oh, he liked her. We already knew that. I'm sorry. We already knew that. She already knew that. She's stupid to think not. And what really bothered me in this episode was that more than focus on that dynamic and really nurturing it, they brought up the whole Matt thing.
Yeah. I didn't like that at all.
Why?
It just seems so contrived.
It was
like, they're in the, especially when he brings it up, they're in the middle of the swamp. They're looking for this kid who has left the hospital, who's sick, and then he is, And even his mom, who's the sheriff, was like, dude, you know, don't, you know, she even like was trying, even that bothered me too, because I'm like, no, that opened the door to it. And then they followed it up on the boat. And that was just like, no, no, we don't need stupid triangles like that, especially manufactured ones where you're putting it so on the nose.
Right. Like, we understand this kind of love triangle exists in the books. And of course, you're going to have him be a police officer versus a swamp thing, because it's like law and order kind of deal.
Yeah.
It just, I don't know. It feels really contrived, like really contrived. And it really bothered me throughout this episode. Because, I mean, all it takes is for you to look at Wikipedia about Swamp Thing and you're like, oh, I see what they're going to do. And then they start feeding the lines. And I'm like, well, we never saw that. We never saw Matt, like, kind of get hung up on Abby. We don't see, or really, Alec and Abby literally just met yesterday.
Yeah.
Like they did they fall in love in a day? Can
love at first like, sight? I guess so. Yeah, that was one of the things that was my complaint about the pilot, was that I thought they rushed it too much. I know you said you would have preferred they would have waited until the season two or maybe the season finale to unveil Swamp Thing and really build on Abby and Alec's relationship and explore the town and all the accelerant and all the things that we're seeing now as far as the disease and the swamp.
Mm-hmm. Now, in talking about Abby, I do think the writers are doing a good job exploring this whole dynamic between her and the Sunderlands, because while in the pilot episode, we saw her interact with the mom about Shauna's death and there being some hostility, to say the least. The dad is like, you always are welcome here. However, if you want to talk business, well, I'm going to be mean.
Yeah.
I'm going to say no. I'm going to shut you down right now. But you're also the daughter I never had or had, but died. Who clearly died in the swamp.
And it's probably tied to this. We'll see that it's tied to what the larger things with the accelerant and everything else is going on right now.
Yeah, and are they going to explain to us how a house got stuck in that swamp?
I just figured it was a hurricane.
Well, you being from there, you know things like that. Me being from Alaska, I'm like, who would build a house in the middle of a swamp like that? Did it just, like, did the accelerant take over a house or something?
No, it probably was a structure. Someone probably lived there years ago when it was just abandoned, you know, due to could have been a hurricane or some other reason. But that's probably why because it had a dock and stuff. So clearly it was someone's residence some time ago. And just like we've seen other structures and people's, like the restaurant and some other things that we've seen in the series so far. So I wouldn't get too hung up on that one.
Yeah. You know, I also thought it was a bit strange, that whole scene between the fortune teller and the mom.
Yeah.
Because it kind of felt like, it kind of feels as if suddenly that now that Abby is back, the mom really wants to further investigate Shauna's death. It's been like, what, 14 years?
Yeah. Well, maybe, yeah. She just never, well, like the fortune teller or the voodoo priestess was trying to tell her, move on. But
What was she doing after Shauna died and between then when Shauna died and now when Abby's returned? What was she doing?
I think she's just been basically going in circles in her grief. I mean, I think some of the conversations that Mr. Sunderland had with her shows that she has just been in that place for years. And then Abby showing back up in town just brought, well, it's always been at the surface, but now now she has the person who she blames for Shauna's death is back and she's, going to aggressively act out about it. And I guess, you know, going to the priest, the voodoo priestess, was and trying to get her to channel her spirit and stuff and talk to her. I don't know. I think she, yeah, I mean, clearly there's some mental, there's some depression, there's other mental instability there. And so, but she was just trying, I think she was trying to make that connection with her daughter again. Mm-hmm. And this is the way that she was trying to do it through the supernatural, which, you know, I couldn't help but think about Cloak and Dagger when I saw that.
Yeah.
I was like, seen this before. It's done a little bit better with Gentile, but.
Yeah, I prefer that kind of magic and voodooism, definitely. Speaking of connection, in this episode, we learned that Swamp Thing is connected to the little girl who Abby has promised the Sunderlands will be okay as soon as she figures out an antidote to the disease. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I thought so.
I don't know, merge together that storyline, which brought her here to begin with, also with what happened with Alec at the end of the last episode together.
Yeah. I agree. I like that. It was a good way to bridge Alec, what happened to Alec and become a Swamp Thing to Abby, as you said. And, I just wish, to your point again, it just seemed a bit rushed.
Yeah.
To get there.
Why is it only the little girl who he's connected to? Because they have several patients who all have that same disease.
Yeah. And maybe they're all interconnected. We just haven't seen it yet.
Which I mean would be a logic flaw then in this episode, because they kind of made it seem like it was only between him and the little girl.
That's true.
I don't know. What were your thoughts on Jason Woodrow? We were introduced to, and we learned that he developed the accelerant, and he is also, from what I understand, is supposed to become Floranic Man.
Yeah. Again, I need to do my homework on Swamp Thing. I haven't yet, but as far as the character in the show and also his wife, I guess they're both responsible for the accelerant. He was a very, when he first showed up at Sunderland's house, I was like, this is a very obviously an odd bird. And I could see, not knowing more about Floranic Man, He's definitely very tied to research in the swamp and nature and stuff, because I know he was talking to the guy who was working in the yard about how to help the plant, the tree, get strengthened. And, so he struck me as the naive scientist who was getting manipulated by Sunderland. For whatever Sunderland's ultimate ends are as far as developing this accelerant to control the swamp and the areas around it. And so he just seemed kind of, he obviously didn't seem that very savvy to those kind of things, but his wife definitely was.
I didn't pick up on the manipulation. I actually thought it was interesting because you have clearly Sunderland, businessman, wants to make money, wants everything to be replenished so that he can use things for drugs and other purposes. He's clearly capitalism, right? Here we are introduced to the scientist who's clearly a little off. Mm-hmm. But he's just at the end of the day, I feel like, I would describe him as like that academic where mm-hmm. he's just slowly zoned in on his research. And being right and like being smarter than everybody else in the room and owning that, and clearly like his research won't have consequences. So I think there's a naiveness about him that I actually thought was really good. I love how he treated his wife in that scene. I think that's very important. She, FYI, will die this season.
Okay.
No, if you're gonna turn him into a supervillain, considering like that last line at the end of there, she's clearly gotta die for him to suddenly.
Oh yeah.
And which could, like, and I know I hate to rub salt in your wound, Will, because it got canceled, but would be a really interesting arc because she would die in the swamp, the very thing he is responsible for having created.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's, I think that, I hope you're right. I mean, that would be for a very, very great arc for this story and also how the swamp sort of ties back to Sunderland's motivations for even getting the accelerant. Mm-hmm. And also I think Mrs. Sunderland and Shauna's death. I mean, all of these things are interrelated, interconnected. And as we move forward in the series, we'll obviously see how they are.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's to just go on to, back on circle back to the girl and or I think her name is Susie and Alex connection. Susie represents the patient Abby has promised to save. Mm-hmm. Alec will become the patient she will spend the rest of her career trying to save, but will never be able to.
Yeah.
Speaking of this. I think it's got some parallels there, but it's already been canceled.
Yeah, it has. It has. I wanted to talk about the Swamp Thing himself, and especially I have to give some props to Derek Mears' work with the prosthetics and the costume. I mean, again, this is the practical effects suit. It's not CGI, or if it – well, it's probably majority practical effects, but – whenever he was with Susie there at the end, when he rescued her from the Hick who was trying to kill her, I really liked the emotions that he was able to convey through the suit. And I just wanted to bring it up because I really, the things that where we're seeing this swamp monster and stuff, it really, whenever he saw Abby and when Abby was trying to brawl Susie down because she just didn't, you know, obviously was afraid of him. I just felt that emotion of the disappointment and the anguish that Alec was feeling in that moment. And I just thought it was a super cool job portraying that through the costume.
The costume is definitely growing on me, pun intended. especially in this episode because, I love, for some reason, I really liked the scenes where he was like recognizing what he became and started like literally pull him because you feel like when you first, if you were Alec, you'd be like, oh, I have this green stuff growing on me. So yoink. And it's like, it keeps, he literally tried to tear himself apart.
Yeah.
Only to realize that. Because it's caught, because it's a repercussion of the accelerant, it grows back. Mm-hmm. Like, and there's something very Hulk-like about that.
Yeah.
Like, he will not be able to kill himself because he can't, even though he would want to because he's a monster. So they're playing on a lot of those themes that we've come to know and love.
Yep.
But I hear you when you say, like, the acting within the suit itself is also being very well. It's just like with Cliff on Doom Patrol where,
yeah.
I mean, again, another practical effect where, but you believe it even though you can't see anybody emotionally. It's all within the eyes.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. Well, I think it's time for us to move out of the swamp and to head up to New York. So a collider just made me do it. I blame them. We both watched mm-hmm. When They See Us.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't seen it, you should see it. If you haven't seen this and you don't want to for whatever reason, then at least go check out the documentary they released a few years back. And that's where my hesitation for this came from. I'd already seen the documentary, so I felt like I know the story or knew
right.
the story.
Right.
And the documentary is really good. Like, it's not a bad documentary either.
Yeah.
So what really captivated me watching the four episodes of When They See Us is just Ava DuVernay's directing and bringing the story to life a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like her directing style. Like, give her an Emmy. Like, Jesus yeah. Christ. Episode yeah. 3 has one of the best montages that I've seen in a while. I just love the time lapse where the phone calls and moving from different rooms. Like, I loved that. I thought that was so creative and ingenious. And then the shot that broke my heart was, I think it's right at the end of episode 1 where they're all in, still in holding, and they start to piece together who they are in these stories that they've told the cops. And that there was something very haunting about that.
It was very haunting. I mean, I'm very familiar with the story. I haven't seen the Ken Burns and Sarah Burns documentary, Central Park 5. I'm going to go back and I was hoping to watch it this weekend, but it just ran out of time and wasn't able to compare the two. Because I think this, whereas I think I haven't seen the documentary, but you know, when you think documentary, it's very fat. Here are the facts. Here's the story. This one, When They See Us, definitely is the emotion and the human side of it and the human story and the anguish. And, you know, and for me, having just professionally dealt with a situation in my professional life where I did work with an individual who was wrongly convicted of a crime, and DNA evidence fortunately exonerated him, and being able to see and feel the emotion of someone and talk to someone who's been wrongfully accused of a crime and mistreated by the criminal justice system, and then being exonerated, you know, this movie really, and this documentary show really spoke to me on so many levels. So there were moments when, you know, obviously the as far as the story, the anger, about how, you know, when the interrogation rooms and seeing how they twisted the stories and how they manipulated these poor kids and knowing that, you know, I know it's a dramatization of it, but knowing that something like this really did happen and how, obviously, when I remember just the Central Park 5, I remember this story with the New York jogger growing up and, you know, Donald Trump being on CNN and all the issues around it. So it's a necessary watch. It's a hard watch, but I'm glad I did watch it because it really does pull the eyes back on so many of the injustices that happens in the world and how the system does break down. And I think Ava's direction, like you said, not only captures the emotion but just from a filmmaking standpoint and production standpoint, yeah, I mean, it's just, give her an Emmy already because, I really felt like I was those kids. The way she directed this and those families and the lawyers and even when you on the state side, you know, she didn't make the prosecutors cartoon characters or the cops cartoon characters. I mean, she really handled this with the great manner that the show didn't descend into that because it could have easily done so, but she didn't let that happen.
I actually felt like I was on the jury during a lot of what was happening, the way it was told. It, for some reason, it put me in that place. Because they kept jumping around, because technically there's 5 stories they have to tell, and then you add on the Felicity Huffman's character.
Yeah.
And it's like that villain sixth character. So I felt, and that's probably where the story, if there are flaws in it, that's what lost me a little bit, was trying to retain focus on the story while giving all of the characters equal time, also equal attention, because five lives were changed forever. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard. It's like a juggling act.
Yeah.
The five kid actors are all going to pop up in mainstream television and film within the next few years, because their performances.
Oh, yeah.
Like, hands down, really good. Which, I have to say, in comparison to the adult actors, I kind of miss the kids when we went forward. I was like, I really like seeing this from that perspective more. Like, it's weird. It's weird to say, but it was something about it, excuse me, that I was really drawn into those stories. And then the post-prison, it kind of it left me to lack or for something to be desired. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. But those kids like hooked me like line and sinker.
Yeah, they did. I will say, I know I praised a lot about the show. I know you really liked episode 3. It was episode 3 for me was the hardest to watch. I mean, it lost me multiple times, and I think you're right. It was because something was lost in the transition between their stories as teenagers and kids, and when they become adults.
See, episode 4 was the hardest for me to watch. Because by the time we got to episode 4, I started remembering more of the documentary, and I was like, oh, I know what happens.
You don't have to watch, yeah.
So it just started coming back to me, and there was just, it was kind of like, okay, this is the end, this is what, it, wrapping up and everything. There was just something about it where I found myself skipping ahead on some scenes because.
Yeah.
It wasn't as there where, which is interesting, but clearly like everybody's viewing experience is different.
Yeah. I mean, I think the episode 4, you know, focusing on Corey and his ordeal, given that he was at the time the only one, you know, given that he was 16 and at the time that was, at least in New York State, that was the age for being charged as an adult, and being, he was in the adult system. So, he, obviously his journey was different from the other four.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that was why they focused on his plight more so than the others. I mean, we did see with Raymond, his descent, especially in episode 3 when he was trying to just make it. And of course he did go back to prison for selling, possessing crack. Mm-hmm. So we saw, I think those two individuals, we saw a lot more. I mean, I felt like we saw a lot more of their stories. Obviously with Corey, episode 4 was all about him, with others being dropped in here and there.
Corey, I understand why she did it that way. It makes sense. The most interesting thing about his story, well, it's weird because it's interesting how he was not originally on their list of names. Mm-hmm. And how he got pulled into the whole thing. That's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And again, that documentary, like, as I'm watching it, I'm like, oh yeah, cause they show some of the tape that he did. And it's like, it's gut wrenching to like, and I don't know if they explain that in the documentary about how he got involved like that, but I do remember seeing the tape being shown. Mm-hmm. And just knowing how they withheld food and all of that. And I like how there was that Coke on the table. Like, clearly he's also hopped up on sugar.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, like, that's more dramatic. The prison stuff for me and Corey, how the case ultimately gets solved is also linked to Corey. Mm-hmm. But what I want to know more about is the brief bio at the end about Corey and how he is now going after people with wrongful convictions and helping them. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I want to know that story more, because knowing what it was like for the other kids once they got out and how they all went on their separate paths, but knowing where he ends up after getting out of even the quote-unquote adult jail system, that's even more fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I wish they would have focused a little bit more on that, because there were some parts of episode 4 that, I did kind of zip through, because I'm like, I understand the abuse that he was subjected to, and I guess it was sort of, I guess it was in put there to sort of provide context so that whenever he did finally have that initial confrontation with the actual rapist, Reyes, over TV set of all things. I guess that was sort of why she, you know, had those scenes in there, just to sort of give fuller context as far as, like, you know, he was constantly getting the physically assaulted throughout his time in prison. But I do, like you, I do wish they had spent a little bit more time as far as, like, okay, here's his life today. Here's how he has, you know, spent a portion of that settlement money that he received from New York, doing the post-conviction work and showing how he's talked about his experience. And I think, I mean, the Colorado Institute's actually named after him now, after his endowment to them. So, you know, I wish they would have focused a little bit more on that, but, you know, it's, especially given that it's a, you know, dramatization of what happened to them.
Right.
But it's just so much. I mean, again, you're trying to tell five people's stories as far as what happened to them. Plus, as you said, you have the states and the detectives, and I mean, four episodes. I mean, I think that she did a lot with the four episodes that she did, and I still, you know, in comparing this documentary, I can't help but think about the People v. OJ as far as another.
It has that written all over it.
Yeah,
like from production style.
Yeah, yeah,
it's very similar.
Yeah, I was comparing. I mean, as I was watching it, I kept going back to that show, because to me, that one still is sort of the gold standard for these types of programs.
Yeah, and now what that show does differently is there's like a whole episode dedicated to the juror's point of view.
Right.
I always think about that, or the prosecutor's point of view. However, there are arguably a little more issues involved in that case, because you have like civil rights, and then you have, and everything is like a boiling pot. And in this show, it's more about like, no, the loss of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
Just because of the color of your skin.
Yeah.
And the being vulnerable when you are a child in this system.
Mm-hmm.
And people manipulating and the cops. So there was clear story here think that she wanted to tell, and she told it. And I don't think it's bad that she didn't try to do anything more. She was, I think the cool thing is we saw a lot from the parents.
Yeah.
With those moments I really liked.
Yeah.
Because especially like they also, because of the media around the case, their lives also drastically changed.
Yeah.
They lost their jobs and all sorts of stuff. A lot of crap happened to them.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It was a very complete show. I mean, I think you're right. I'm glad you brought up about the impacts on the families, because a lot of times in these types of programs, that aspect can get glossed over. Mm-hmm. But here it didn't. And, you know, and also we think of, Antoine, was it Antoine? This is his father, who basically like told him to like, yeah, you tell the police what they want to hear so you can get out of here. And, yeah. And also I think back to, when in the other interrogation room where, the sister was, there and how they just coerced that and the powerful thing with the mother, with, was it UCF's mother who basically was like understanding her rights and how the system was just basically trying to railroad a confession out of him. And
which I don't understand why they didn't invite her to the stand.
Yeah.
I don't get that. She clearly understands the law and what her rights, and she had a story to tell. So why didn't they have the smart idea of putting her on the stand?
Yeah. 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 I mean, as a lawyer, that's one of the things that, and I don't know if the other documentary addressed that or not, but I mean, there were definitely is watching the trial, where clearly some of like a couple of the kids' lawyers were definitely, you know, were criminal and they had some pretty competent defense. But, you know, we have a family law lawyer representing one of the kids. The only thing he does is divorce, you know, and there's just so many layers to the onion as far as what was so messed up about what happened in this case. And it really is a reflection of just, again, does point the spotlight on in the inequities in the system and inequities in American life at times. And so, and explore with this case.
Yeah, there was that scene with Corey on trial. Really made me look back on another Netflix show, Making a Murderer. Because after watching that show, I called up my dad and I was like, I've never been more appreciative of my intelligence. And that may be like a cocky thing to say, but it's just that you see in stories like those, you see how fortunate you are to know a little more than others, because when you don't, the less you know, the more vulnerable you are.
And
I think that like that's a good parallel to what you brought up about one of their fathers who also immediately started to, how do I put it, like to shudder away and like even though he's an adult, he's still a black man and surrounded by white police officers who are telling him like this is what you have to do, and being manipulated and thinking like, okay, if this is the only way out, let me take it.
Yep.
So it's just there. The vulnerability, I think, is really what's shown.
I'll just end it by saying that again, it's a story that it may be hard to watch, but you should watch it.
I 100% agree. And then just if it hits you too hard, just watch Always Be My Maybe right afterwards.
Yeah.
With The Cure.
There you go.
Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Yeah, you can find me at Will M. Polk. That's WILLMPOLK.
You can find me at SJ Belmont, SJBELMONT. Please follow our crew on Twitter at Scene and Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram. But most importantly, rate, subscribe, and comment on iTunes, SoundCloud, YouTube, and Spotify. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.
Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.